Acres Future versus the State of Nevada. This is case number 56283. Counsel, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, ma'am.
And the correct pronunciation of your name is Torchinsky?
Torchinsky, yes.
And of course, I know that our clerk, or I trust that our clerk has advised you of the time that you see in front of you is your full allocated time, and so when you get the five-minute warning, you are into your rebuttal time.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
Very well.
May it please the Court. On behalf of Alliance for America's Future, Kara Ahern and Patty Heck, I am Jason Torchinsky of Holtzman & Vogel, and with me today is Scott Shearer of Holland & Hart. Last May, the Alliance for America's Future began airing a television advertisement in Nevada discussing a number of public policy issues and referring to Brian Sandoval, who's on those issues. The Alliance undertook this advertising in reliance on the generally accepted understanding of the term expressly advocate as used in First Amendment jurisprudence and Nevada's definition of expenditure, and believed its advertisement was not subject to regulation by the State of Nevada. The Secretary of State subsequently maintained that the advertisement was subject to Nevada's campaign finance laws, and then sought and obtained a temporary restraining order removing the Alliance's advertisement from the airwaves. 5 days after the temporary restraining order was imposed, a preliminary injunction hearing was held before the District Court. The District Court substantially found for the Secretary, but issued an opinion that the Alliance believes contains several serious errors of law. In light of this context, where the state sought an order prohibiting further airing of an advertisement discussing public issues, we are confronted with two key constitutional questions. First, what does advocate expressly in Nevada's definition of expenditure mean? And second, is Nevada's definition of political committee appropriately tailored with a major purpose limitation?
Why does the Alliance fear transparency? What's their problem with transparency in government in this day and age, especially with what's going on?
Well, Your Honor, a couple things. One, where you have transparency and where you have disclosure requirements, there's usually notice in advance that those disclosure requirements are going to apply. And disclosure itself is really not a panacea in campaign finance. As Justice Thomas noted in his opinion in Citizens United, supporters of Proposition 8 in California, the gay marriage ban, suffered property damage, threats of physical violence and death. As a result, people lost their jobs, they had their businesses protested. Even in testimony before the Federal Election Commission about the scope of disclosure regulations under the FEC's election and communications regulations, counselor for the AFL-CIO testified that there's no public policy value at all in requiring an organization to disclose its entire membership because it engaged in some election and communications. And counsel for the SEIU echoed these concerns. And in CFIF versus Tenet, in reviewing a West Virginia law on election and communications and the disclosure requirement there, the court said, the practical effect of requiring expansive disclosure is not only to compel a flood of information that is not necessarily relevant to the purpose of the regulation it supportedly serves, to provide the electorate with information as to who is speaking. And here's the key. Not only, and this is from the court, not only may a large swath of general treasury contributors not support an organization's election and communications, they may not even be aware that the organization is engaging in electioneering communications. And even if the exacting scrutiny test applies, there's a limit here because the exacting scrutiny test requires that the information that the government is seeking to advance this governmental interest be connected to the speech that is being engaged in. And so you run the risk of getting information about a lot of donors that had absolutely nothing to do with the communication, didn't know their donation was going to be used in that way, or who didn't know that the organization was even going to engage in such communications. So just a plain disclosure provision is way overbroad in the First Amendment context.
Counsel, is your first constitutional argument mooted by the amendments to the legislation in 2011? Your first constitutional argument.
About the definition of express advocacy?
Yes.
No, because that definition goes into effect on October 1, 2011, and we're talking about an advertisement that took place in May of 2010. I think that the legislature's change in the statute is informative of what the legislature intended in the statute that is currently in effect right now. You know, even if you go to the bill itself, AB 81, the heading prepared by legislative counsel talked about how that the legislation that's coming into effect on October 1st. You know, is a change in the legislation. In fact, right in the heading, it says changes concerning campaign contributions and expenditures. And so,
but let's say time forward that we don't do same-day service and your opinion isn't issued until end of October. At that point, if we were to dissolve the injunction and you were to run that ad, it would be subject to the new definition, correct?
It would be.
Correct. But the new definition, I think, has constitutional problems as well because...
Counsel, that's not before us today.
Correct. That is not before us today. You're right.
But it, so why isn't the first issue mooted by virtue of the amendments being made by the legislature, the first constitutional issue?
Because the my client is subject to potentially civil liability as a result of an advertisement that it aired because it didn't file the registration and disclosure. So even if, you know, even if this court doesn't reach that question, my client still faces the possibility of civil liability in the district court. So I don't think that you can really moot it when...
But you're here on an appeal from a preliminary injunction, correct?
Correct. And if
there were penalties, nothing assessed.
Right, at that time. And then the district court indicated, before the appeal was filed, the district court had actually contacted us and wanted to schedule further proceedings, and the secretary was prepared to seek civil penalties.
Counsel, if that occurs, you can come back and see us again, but that's not before us today.
That's correct.
Or the logic.
I wonder, counsel, if you could... for my benefit, focus your argument on the second constitutional concern, because I can see where that wouldn't be mooted. The definition of the pact and the major purpose or the purpose limitation.
Yes.
Pretty extensively discussed in Tenet.
Yes. I mean, even if this court concludes that the alliance engaged in an expenditure under the statute, the registration and disclosure requirements need some kind of tailoring in order to meet with First Amendment rights of privacy and rights of association. Under the Secretary's interpretation, Nevada's campaign finance law would require the disclosure of every contributor to any organization that made even a single expenditure, regardless of whether that contribution was even related to the expenditure. And as I mentioned, you know, counsel for the AFL-CIO and counsel for the SEIU have already testified about the burdens that would be placed on their organization and how they felt that that was information that was beyond what was necessary to satisfy the governmental requirements. You know, every court to consider the major purpose question when you're dealing with a PAC statute, with the exception of Human Life Society versus Brumsicle, has concluded that the singular major purpose requirement is what's needed. Because without that bright line test, it's too difficult to know what a court may conclude might be one of multiple major purposes and what factors a court might look to. So by using a singular major purpose test, the Fourth Circuit and the Tenth Circuit have recognized that that is really the bright line that's needed to bring clarity to this political action committee area and determine what could actually be regulated. Because the political action committee statute, for example, the political action committee statute that was at issue in National Organization of Marriage versus McKee out of Maine had two different kinds of PACs. There was the so-called major purpose PAC, which was actually not addressed because National Organization of Marriage, there was no question that it didn't fall into that category. But there was a secondary definition of a non-major purpose PAC, and the key to upholding the constitutionality of the non-major purpose PAC provision was the limitation on disclosures. The limitation on disclosures contained in the statute in the non-major purpose PAC provision in National Organization of Marriage versus McKee was limited to contributions that were made for the purpose of influencing elections in Maine and then general treasury transfers to make up the rest of any money that was spent in Maine by a non-major purpose PAC. So if you got $1,000 from somebody that you knew that they knew was going to be used in Maine, you would disclose that person, and then you would just show general treasury transfers, you know, one lump sum from a general treasury where you're not disclosing individual donors to make up the rest. And so the sort of broad PAC definition that the state is trying to apply to the alliance here was not even at issue in McKee. So you've got LEAK, you've got New Mexico Youth Organized, you've got Federal Election Commission versus GOPAC out of the DC District Court. And there's a whole series of cases where, you know, the courts have limited political committee status to organizations that have a singular major purpose. I mean, even the Federal Election Commission says they apply a singular major purpose test, although they have a multi-factor test for determining what constitutes major purpose. But even in the FEC's rules, it's a singular major purpose question.
Can the exclusions or exemptions in 055 satisfy constitutionally the major purpose or purpose language? And if not, why not?
The exclusions there are exclusions, as the state points out properly, are exclusions from the definition of political action committee, but they still apply the broad disclosure requirements to any organization or any person that engages in expenditures and require that they register or that require that they report their expenditures and also report their contributions. There's two different sections of the statute, one that requires reporting of contributor or of expenditures and the other that requires reporting of contributions. And contributions is so broadly defined that if you had, let's say, a business corporation that spent $150 on signs, under the state's reading of the statute, almost every customer of that business would have to be disclosed because a contribution is any payment. And so with that, I would like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
But your pact wouldn't fall, excuse me, Chief, may I ask a further question? Your pact wouldn't fall under 1A because the issue doesn't have to do with contributions that you intend to give to candidates or other persons. Your pact would be under 1B relating to expenditures to affect the outcome of any primary, general, or special election question on the ballot, correct?
Right. The Alliance has not made contributions to anyone, to any candidate in the ballot.
So the evaluation of whether you are a committee for political action is going to be focused on expenditures.
Correct.
And the absence, your argument, I just want to understand your argument. Your argument is that the absence of purpose or major purpose language in that section of the statute renders it unconstitutional.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Torchinsky. Mr. Benson?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Kevin Benson, Deputy Attorney General on behalf of the respondent, Ross Miller, Secretary of State. AAF asked this Court to hold that as a constitutional matter, the definition of express advocacy cannot be applied without limiting it both to organizations that have the major purpose of influencing elections and also to the context of electioneering communications. No court has ever held that that test has to be so narrowly construed in order to reach constitutional muster. Such a holding would, as a practical matter, cause the exceptions to swallow the rule, and disclosure would be required only in the most rare of circumstances. That's not what the legislature intended, and that's not what is required by the federal constitution. To address first the issue of the major purpose test versus the A major purpose test, that derives from the Buckley decision. And at issue in Buckley was a law that required disclosures for all expenditures made for the purpose of influencing a federal election. It was a much broader test to begin with than what we're dealing here, which is the functional equivalency of using magic words. And in that case, it is true that Buckley limited that as a matter of statutory construction, not a facial challenge to the statute itself, to groups that are either controlled by a candidate or which have, I'll say for the sake of argument, the major purpose of influencing an election, of electing a candidate. However, I think the better rule is those that are adopted by the Ninth Circuit and by the First Circuit in McKee, which adopt the A major purpose test instead for two reasons. First of all, the functional equivalency test does not raise the same vagueness concerns that were at issue in Buckley because it is already a considerably more narrow test than what was at issue in there. Therefore, the A major purpose test is sufficient to meet constitutional requirements for vagueness. Additionally, as the Ninth Circuit explained in the Brumsicle case, the major purpose test causes arbitrary results because there's really no principled distinction between requiring disclosures for a group that spends 51% of its resources on political advocacy versus a group that spends 50%. Or in the example that it gave in that case, you have one group that spends 40% on political advocacy, 30% on merchandising, 30% on research. Another group spends 45% on political advocacy, 45% on merchandising, and 10% on research and development. The first group has the major purpose of political advocacy because it spends the majority of its resources to that end. The second group does not. It only has a major purpose, even though, as a percentage of its resources, it spends more than the first group. That leads to an arbitrary result based only on the particular configuration of each individual group at issue. We should be cautious, in light of Citizens United, to be drawing such distinctions based on the identity or the type of the speaker at issue.
But counsel, our statute, 055, in defining a committee for political action, doesn't use the word purpose at all.
That is correct, and nor did the law that was at issue in Buckley. And as the Supreme Court clarified in McConnell, Buckley's result for the or a major purpose test was a matter of statutory construction. It did not appear in the statute there. It was not a constitutional command, and it did not render the statute facially unconstitutional. Again, it was a narrowing construction related to the particular law at issue in the court there.
Well, that may be true, but didn't that also impact the extent of the First Amendment reach and who that could, what controls could be placed on the expert dollars?
It did, and again, that was because the law at issue there reached any communications for the purpose of influencing, which the Buckley court felt did pose some vagueness concerns. In this
doesn't this language makes or intends to make expenditures designed to affect the outcome? Isn't that language pretty broad to impact the same vagueness concerns Buckley expressed?
It is not, Your Honor, because it references the term make expenditure, and expenditure itself is defined as express advocacy under Nevada law. Therefore, by putting the two definitions together, what we have is actually much, much narrower test than what is at issue in Buckley. And in Buckley, as they describe in the court, what they were trying to get at is speech that is unambiguously campaign-related. When you have a test where communications require disclosure, when they can have no other reasonable interpretation other than an appeal to vote for or against a clearly identified candidate that's on the ballot, clearly that is unambiguously campaign-related. Therefore, this test does not raise the same vagueness concerns that were at issue in Buckley, and it's not necessary to further eliminate it by applying the major purpose test, or any major purpose test for that matter. But should the court feel it necessary, the a major purpose test is more appropriate in this case because we already have a more narrowly tailored test, and it does not produce arbitrary results like those pointed out in the Brumsickle decision.
Could you comment on the issue of vagueness and assume, for analysis' sake, that we've fast-forwarded a month and we're into October, so the new statute has taken effect. Where are we on this appeal from a preliminary injunction with respect to live issues remaining?
There are additional issues that will remain in this case. While the registration of the PAC itself may be moot, there are also reporting disclosures which AAF has not complied with either.
Those are not the subject of the injunction that's before us on direct appeal, though, correct?
Not presently, but the resolution of these issues here will directly impact those matters as well.
But explain to me why you just said a moment ago that registration as a PAC is no longer live either if we're fast forwarding to November 1st.
Because the election is over. And therefore the registration period has, you know, the idea of registering before they have engaged in this activity has, you know, no longer any practical purpose for this election. But
so why should we reach the issues on this appeal at all?
Well, as I do agree with the appellants in this case that if this, whichever way this court rules, will impact whether AAF will be liable for civil penalties for its failure to report its donors, which it has also refused to comply with as well.
Well, so counsel, are you prepared to stipulate that the provision of the preliminary injunction, the first provision on lines 13 through 15 on page 9, in which it says Alliance, Ms. Heck, and Ms. Ahern are prohibited from any PAC activity in Nevada until Alliance is registered with the Secretary, becomes null and void on October 1st, 2011?
No, I don't think the enactment of the law, as you know, it only changed, did not change, it added a definition of express advocacy where none existed before. That only addresses the definition of expenditure. It does not relate to or impact in any way.
No, but I'm confused by your comment or your response to Justice Pickering. You said that registration would become moot on October 1st. And this prohibition in the order is that they can't conduct any PAC activity in Nevada until they register. So if registration becomes moot, then it would seem like this order would still be in effect. It would have to be vacated in some respect on October 1st, wouldn't it?
My apologies. I think I may have misspoke then to your question. I think that they're, what I'm getting at in terms of mootness is their argument that the injunction was not proper under the statute. I think that issue is moot because this election has passed in any event. If they were to run the exact same ad, which I don't see why they would in the next coming election, because presumably Mr. Sandoval will not be running again for governor in 2012, I don't see how it would have application. If they ran a different ad, then we may be back here again on a similar type case, but it won't be the exact same case.
But given the breadth of this injunction, they can't do anything until they register.
They cannot engage in PAC activity, which is necessarily defined by making expenditures that expressly advocate for or against a candidate.
Mr. Benson, let me ask you this on hypotheticals. We're talking about the governor's races until 2014, but I don't know who this group is and who they're sponsoring, but let's say they wanted to run an ad in the 2012 Senate race that Dean Heller is the conservative candidate and Shelley Berkeley is the liberal candidate or something like that. I guess that's kind of a paraphrasing what this was about. Would they be permitted to do that in 2012 because of the injunction, or how would you look at that?
Under those are, of course, are federal races, which are controlled by federal law and federal campaign finance law, which we do not reach under our statute.
Okay, that's true. And so because it's a federal race, it wouldn't impact that.
Correct.
Okay.
I want to touch
briefly. To expand Justice Gibbons' question, what if the group decided to weigh in on the state Senate races and comment about the conservative or liberal credentials of state Senate candidates?
Once again, I think, Your Honor, it would depend on, presumably they're not running the exact same ad. And if they ran an ad that was a true issue ad and was not the functional equivalent of express advocacy, then they would not be engaging.
Well, let's just assume they run the same ad as they've got right here, but instead of Brian Sandoval's name, they substitute Barbara Sagafsky's name. They'd be in violation, I would assume, from the Secretary's point of view.
Yes, I believe they would be.
And unless this injunction is vacated, you'd seek further penalties because they hadn't registered, now because they hadn't complied with the court's order. Is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Yeah, okay.
I want to touch briefly on one of the questions.
The analysis of whether that ad, the new Sagafsky ad, was PAC expenditures would be made under the 2011 version of the statute, correct?
That is correct, because at that point the law would be in place, would be effective. Turning briefly to the electioneering communications issue that this court asked us to address on oral argument, the court asked whether there is any constitutional barrier to applying the functional equivalency test outside the definition of electioneering communications. And the quick answer to that is no, simply because there is no binding authority that stands for that position. They've relied largely on Chief Justice Roberts' statements in Wisconsin Right for Life 2. That's not binding authority for several reasons. It's dicta. It was only joined by one other judge. But most importantly, the law at issue in that case had to do with, first of all, it imposed a complete prohibition on speech. Second, it punished violators with felony criminal penalties. This case, by contrast, only deals with disclosure and does not impose any criminal penalties. As the Supreme Court has made clear from Buckley through Citizens United, laws that only require disclosure are subject to a less stringent standard of review. Instead, this court should follow those cases that have found that the functional equivalency test can be applied outside that context. Fergatch is the most obvious example. At the time that it was decided, there was no such thing as electioneering communications. And it's from the holding in that court that the functional equivalency test was ultimately derived. More recently, the First Circuit upheld Maine's laws and also Rhode Island's laws that applied their definition of independent expenditure using express advocacy and the functional equivalency test outside the electioneering communication definition. This issue of whether it's confined to the level of reporting that is required. AAF even wrote right in its reply brief that it is not addressing that issue on this appeal, but that it reserves its chance to do so later on in this litigation should it remain a live issue. And the McKee case and the Deleuze case from the First Circuit that were recently decided additionally upheld that the functional equivalency test outside the electioneering communication context. And in any event, even in Nevada's law, that our functional equivalency test is sufficiently clear to withstand constitutional scrutiny even as a standalone test. The statute only applies to advertisements that clearly identify a candidate. The candidate has to be on the ballot, meaning we have a certain time frame here from the time somebody files their declaration of candidacy until election day. While that is broader than what is required, the 30 and 60 days under federal law, it's nevertheless an absolutely clear, bright line rule.
Counsel, where in the statute as she currently exists do we find the functional equivalency rule?
It is not in the statute as it currently exists. As I explained,
it's not in our jurisprudence.
It is. It has
where would
been
we?
Previously.
It's not in the legislative history.
I believe it is in the legislative history, Your Honor. The legislative council specifically explained to the legislators that the term "express advocacy," although it had been interpreted by some courts as meaning magic words, that was not always the case, and that magic words is one instance where things will be considered express advocacy, and in other instances, it will be taken on the communication as a whole. And that was the understanding that the legislators acted on when they enacted the expression.
I'm a little bit concerned about the court seizing on functional equivalency for a statute adopted in 97 when that phrase or word of art was not coined until many years later.
I think you're correct in that it did not become a term of art until many years later. It did not seem to be until the McConnell case made a statement, expressed advocacy, or its functional equivalent. And although the functional equivalent had not been coined then, the disjunctive use of or caused people to believe that somehow express advocacy was different than the functional equivalent. At the time that this was adopted, FERDACH was the rule in the Ninth Circuit, where of course we're located, and that court had always rejected the notion that express advocacy necessarily means magic words. And that is what the legislators.
Well, that may be true, but it doesn't necessarily substitute it with functional equivalency in the jurisprudence that's been interpreting that phrase since.
And I think I see where you're going here. They didn't adopt the functional equivalency test because obviously it hadn't been invented yet. So the fact that they did not use those words, I don't think really has any bearing because obviously nobody would have thought it was necessary right. to do so at the time. However, that doesn't change the idea that what they understood express advocacy to mean was not limited just to magic words. They just didn't express it. We call it the functional equivalency test now because those are the words we have to work with. Other courts, like the First Circuit case, call it the appeal to vote test. And so we have some new terminology now, but that doesn't mean that they believed and intended it to mean something else back in 1997.
Mr. Benson, before you leave the podium, I want to go back to the hypothetical that has been set forth by this court, and that is the, we'll call it, for lack of a better term, the Sagaski hypothetical. If we assume that that is, in fact, one of the parties that would be subject to an ad, such as was at issue here, and assume that we are post the enactment date of the new law, without registration and without this court or a court vacating the preliminary injunction that presently exists, is it not true that the appellant would still be subject to penalties imposed by the court's order?
I think that the injunction would possibly still apply. There would also be the separate issue of disclosure, which is separate from the registration requirements. If I understand your question, you're getting at the idea of the propriety of the injunctive relief. And if I can quickly address that, I know I'm long.
You may, because I'm going to give the appellants some additional time as well.
Thank you, Your Honor. As to that, first of all, it's a statutory argument that they make. They have not framed it in constitutional concerns. Ordinarily, such an argument raised for the first time on appeal would be waived in any event. But in this case, the statutes, I think, clearly authorize that, authorize injunctive relief. Subsection 1 of NRS 294A 420 provides that anybody who fails to file a report, who fails to register as required by a laundry list of statutes, including the PACT registration statute, the secretary may institute the appropriate proceedings in the First Judicial District Court. Subsection 2 of that same statute says that anyone who violates that same laundry list of statutes is subject to a civil penalty up to $5,000 per violation. Again, the secretary must recover that by bringing in action the First Judicial District Court. So the civil penalties that are authorized in subsection 2 are in addition to any appropriate relief that is authorized in subsection 1. If you hold that only civil penalties are available in this case, then it renders the entire subsection 1 meaningless and useless. They're intended to operate together. In this particular case, although the district court enjoined them from further running the ad, the secretary also requested the court to order them to register as well, which the district court declined to do for reasons that aren't entirely clear from the order. But in short, injunctive relief is necessary because otherwise the purpose and the ability to meaningfully enforce these statutes is going to be severely undermined. The purpose of these statutes, again, is disclosure. Imposing a fine after the fact is not going to serve the purpose of getting the information to the voters in time so that they can use that in making a meaningful decision when they actually cast their ballot. So the fact that in this case the district court declined to order them to register, I don't think precludes any proper injunctive relief. I think that would have been the most proper relief in this case. On the other hand, because it carries out the purpose of the statute in getting that information out to the voters in a timely manner.
Thank you, Mr. Benson.
Thank you.
And Mr. Turchinski, I'm going to give you your entire five-minute rebuttal time since we have clearly bled into Mr. Benson's time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to address a couple of quick points. First of all, the state's position that some more relaxed standard is applicable in Nevada because it's a mere disclosure statute cannot be sustained in light of the secretary's position that it is entitled to injunctive relief prohibiting any speech the secretary deems subject to the law for which a registration is not filed. Even in the federal regulatory scheme in effect, both before and after Citizens United, both criminal and civil violations of registration and disclosure laws are subject to some very detailed complaint and investigation processes, which really provide for no expedited method for the Federal Election Commission to seek to have an ongoing advertisement removed from the airwaves in time for an election. So, and then the other point that I want to get to that Mr. Benson mentioned is the fact that there would still be this disclosure issue without registration, but everything turns on the definition of expenditure. If you don't have to file a registration, you don't have a disclosure obligation. So I don't understand. I'm a little bit confused by the state's position that somehow there's a disclosure obligation that would somehow operate independent of a registration requirement. So I think we should probably leave that for another day.
Counsel, so in a vacuum, you're just saying you can do whatever you want and hell with the law.
No, Your Honor. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that registration and disclosure go hand in hand. If you didn't engage in disclosure, if you didn't engage in activity that required registration, you're not subject to the disclosure requirement. There's nothing in the statute, the way the statutory scheme is set up.
Let's say you are subject to disclosure requirements.
Then you're also subject to registration.
And you would agree with that?
Yes. The registration and disclosure go hand in hand. If you haven't engaged in activity that triggers the registration requirements, you are not subject to disclosure requirements.
And the only activity that triggered the registration requirement here was the expenditures on behalf both past and future of Governor Sandoval, correct?
It was that one particular ad.
To return to this issue of the mootness question, how do you read that preliminary injunction? Do you think that you could run an ad for a state Senate race? And I know you're not from Nevada, but that would be a state Senate, not a federal race, for Barbara Sagafsky touting her conservative credentials in the same time frame relative to the election as this ad that you were enjoined from running. Do you think you would be enjoined from running that ad under this injunction? Or did you understand that injunction to be specific to the Sandoval ads?
I understood the injunction to be a general injunction against the Alliance conducting any further quote-unquote PAC activity in Nevada until it registers. So I don't believe that even if my client were to come up with another ad that it didn't believe was subject to Nevada's requirements, that it couldn't do anything without potentially running afoul of that injunction.
without, you know, without getting some kind of clarification, or like the FEC, like the Supreme Court said in Citizens United, having to basically check with the secretary first to find out whether our speech or our proposed speech is subject to regulation or potential injunction.
Counsel, your position, though, would be that the current expenditure that would in turn trigger the registration requirement would be judged under the 2011 version of the statute.
If my client were to engage in activity after October 1, 2011, yes, it would be that new statute that would be relevant to registration. But then I would also, the language of the preliminary injunction leaves open the question of what happens to, with the prior activity if we decide to do something else.
Well, that becomes basically a violation of that particular order.
Yes, that's the conundrum that my client would find itself in.
Counsel, did your client properly challenge the ability of the court to issue an injunction in the district court, in your view?
Yes, I believe that we did, Your Honor.
Okay. Can you tell me why, or was that raised and all like that? I mean, there's an issue of whether it was raised in district court, and therefore whether it's preserved for appeal as far as the propriety of entering the injunction.
With the TRO, Your Honor, we were never given an opportunity to even be heard before the TRO was issued.
Okay. How about the preliminary injunction when that was challenged?
We objected to the proceeding because we didn't believe we had made an expenditure.
Okay. Thank you.
I want to address a couple of other comments.
But did you challenge whether the statute authorized the issuance of a preliminary injunction procedurally?
May I confer with my co-counsel for just a second? Your Honor, we may not have.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
We may not have, Your Honor. With respect to the electionary communications definition and whether the functional equivalent test can be used outside of the electionary communications context, I think I read Wisconsin Right to Life differently than Mr. Benson.
Please complete your thought.
If you read CFIF v. Tenet and that court's analysis of the functional equivalent test as a freestanding test, it focused on the fact that both Justice Roberts' opinion was joined by another justice where he limited the functional equivalent test to the electionary communications context, and also pointed out that three other justices in a concurring opinion in Wisconsin Right to Life said that they would overrule the functional equivalent test. So you actually have five justices who find that there is some limitation required on the functional equivalent test, three who would overrule the test completely, and two who feel that the vagueness issues presented by the functional equivalent test are appropriately limited when it's in the context of electionary communications.
But counsel, is that truly a grouping, or do we just have three and two?
I think it is a grouping, Your Honor, because, I mean, they addressed each other. If you read Justice Roberts' footnote 7, refers to the concurring opinion and says, I understand their concerns, but I believe that their concerns are appropriately addressed by limiting it to these 30, 60-day windows.
Other questions, colleagues?
Well, but it's pretty clear that Justice Kennedy, Justice Scalia, and Justice Thomas would set aside that test as for vagueness.
Yes, Your Honor.
Other questions? Thank you, both counsel. This case will stand submitted. The court will take a brief recess until 11:30 argument.